Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Chris Hedges. He's a longtime foreign correspondent who is part of a team that won the Pulitzer Prize for their coverage. He's been in combat zones more times than he wishes to recount. He's a powerful social critic and critic of capitalism, as the author of more than 10 books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, Death of the Liberal Class, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He is a columnist for Truth Dig. So first, Chris, thank you, as always, for your fabulous work, and then thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek.
And today, I would like to talk about your new book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. And it's just out within the past week. It's, as all of your work, it's incredibly both important and thoughtful. I want to start with a question. In Wages of Rebellion, you say that rebels have much in common with religious mystics. What do you mean by that, and what do they share?
Baldwin, when he writes about the rebel and the artist, says that it's not so much that they have a vision, but they're propelled by it. And I think that that is true for both the rebel and the artist. There's a moment where Hannah Arendt writes about people who resist, and she says it's not those who say this shouldn't be done or we oughtn't to do this. It's those who say I can't. And I think that's the quality of the rebel. They see and speak and stand up for a truth that not only sees them marginalized, but can often put their lives in danger. They defy what is accepted by the general population as a monolithic and unassailable structure of power, and yet they defy it anyway. I think we forget that most rebels throughout history don't succeed. Most rebels are destroyed. It's only those few rebels who manage to strike the zeitgeist of the times, you know, whether that would be Toussaint in what was Saint-Domingue and later Haiti, you know, whether that would be Robespierre, Che Guevara, and then it's that confluence of that peculiar personality type with these historical or seismic upheavals that suddenly make the rebel relevant. I did an interview in the book with Ronnie Cuss-Reels, who founded the armed wing of the ANC with Nelson Mandela, and I think he made a very good point. He said, He's white. He's Jewish and white. And went underground, was underground for 30 years fighting with the ANC. But he said, I was a rebel in the sense that I turned against my own class, my own race, whereas Mandela was a revolutionary. And I think that rebels never finally fit in into the hierarchies of power. And this was true with Cuss-Reels. So once Mandela appointed him as the deputy defense minister, but he began publicly denouncing the corruption within the ANC. And then when they had that miners' strike and they fired on the crowd, which was the largest killing of laborers since the Sharpeville massacre, he denounced the party and left. We saw the same thing with Che Guevara or Milo Vangelis, who had been Tito's chief lieutenant and heir apparent. And then in the early 50s writes his book, The New Class, which condemns the Yugoslav Communist Party for replicating the lifestyles and privileges of the bourgeois or the bourgeoisie who were overthrown. So that is the nature of rebels. You often don't want them to rule, but you can't carry out a revolt without them.
So I'm liking everything you're saying, and there's a direction I want to go in a moment, but before I get there, there's something that okay, a couple things. One is, one of the ways that I think about whether a rebel fits with their zeitgeist, one of the ways I think about that has to do with music, and I think a way I put it in my own head is that Jimi Hendrix's music would not have succeeded in the 1920s. You know, that a person, an artist of any sort, has to have both, you know, that vision, and the vision also has to speak to those around him, that, or to the larger culture, that Picasso's art would never have succeeded in 1725. And so I think about that with Rebels too. So is that part of what you're saying?
Yes, but I mean, that you're right. I mean, it's the turmoil of the 1960s, which Hendrix gives expression to in his music, in the same way that the kind of dissonance after World War I is given expression by Stravinsky or the Ballet Russe, you know, or all those great painters in Germany, Dix and others. So, but there are moments when rebels rise up, and you know, they become prophetic. Decades later, people see that they understood what was happening to the wider society when others didn't. Herman Melville would be a good example, but in their own lifetime are not appreciated,
right,
for their prophetic kind of understanding of where we're going. So, you know, I think the rebels are always there, and rebels see things that others can't see. I mean, they see beyond the facade. They challenge the structures. They ask questions that others ask. But in moments of relative complacency and stability, the rebel exists on the margins of society and doesn't resonate with the masses. In moments of instability, in moments when the structures of power are being exposed for what they are and questioned, then that rebel comes to the forefront. And then, of course, in moments when those structures begin to crumble and fall, the rebel becomes vital.
So, and I want to, I understand that you're leading us back to politics, and to mass movements, to open revolt, to all of that, but I want to, there's one more thing that's kind of niggling at my mind that I want to address before we really dive in, which is the notion that almost everyone, perceives themselves as, almost every perpetrator of abuse also perceives themselves as being the real victim. And I think that Adolf Hitler perceived himself as being a rebel. And I've got a book coming out in a year and a half that talks about some of the problems in anarchism. And one of the things I talk about for more than 100 pages in there is the relationship between – there has been a lot of support within anarchism for example, pedophilia. And pedophiles perceive themselves quite often as rebels who are asking the tough questions. And so how do we separate – do you see what I'm trying to get at here?
That right. There's, but you're right. They may perceive – but they're self-deluded.
And how do we – can you sort of weave our way between a rebel and a self-deluded rebel? And then we'll get back to your real work here.
Right. Well, I mean, self-deluded individuals who position themselves as leaders or rebels take whole peoples over a cliff, which is precisely what Stalin and Lenin and Hitler did. And as societies break down, they are often very potent and powerful figures. And I think the difference is that a rebel refuses to cater to the desires of the masses, whereas a demagogue reads the desires of the masses and knows how to manipulate them. They certainly, I think you're correct, view themselves that way. But that's because they don't actually have a rational understanding of who they are, what they are about. They're mentally, psychologically, emotionally, and morally deformed.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the dangers of whenever there is a breakdown that, I mean, you've written about this extensively, about how the breakdown can lead to additional fascism.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Once again, the perpetrators of the fascism so often present themselves as the real rebels.
Well, they also present themselves as the real victims even while they're slaughtering other people. I mean, this was true in Yugoslavia, where the Serbs were carrying out ethnic cleansing and genocide in Bosnia, and yet a discussion with a Serb was all about their own victimhood. And you're right. You know, societies and the United States is a very sick, violent culture, and we could very easily go the wrong way. I mean, Yugoslavia, with the breakdown of communism, was the East European country most suited to integrate into Europe. And it had, you know, one of Eastern Europe's most important intellectuals and dissidents, Milo Vangelis. But the society vomited up these frightening figures like Slobodan Milosevic and Radovan Karadzic and Franjo Tuđman in a way that Czechoslovakia did not, and turned to hovel. So there you have two countries. I mean, Yugoslavia should have been Czechoslovakia. But courtesy of pressure from the West that wouldn't allow it to renegotiate its massive loans, which created hyperinflation and the breakdown of society, Gilas was, although he was alive, was a figure largely of ridicule, while Havel in Czechoslovakia, and I was there in Prague for the Velvet Revolution, everybody turned to, although Havel was not a particularly charismatic figure, he wasn't even a very good speaker, but he had the moral authority that in a society like Czechoslovakia, which fortunately didn't suffer the economic disruptions that plagued Yugoslavia, allowed it to create the Velvet Revolution. So, yeah, you're right. Societies can, or, of course, revolutions can be hijacked, which is what Lenin and the Bolsheviks did, destroying the Soviets and carrying out what, in essence, was a kind of right-wing coup, a counter-revolution, and cementing into place state capitalism. So, yeah, I mean, when revolutions are violent, they become more dangerous and more prone to being hijacked, because those who have a propensity for violence and the ability to use it, a skill, which I don't have, makes them able to deal with other factions on the left through violence, to become ascendant. So, you know, we saw that with the Reign of Terror. I mean, it's always the state that will determine whether a revolution is violent. It's not, I mean, people generally start out, even in the French Revolution, through peaceful protest. Even in the Russian Revolution, when they marched to the Tsar for bread and Bloody Sunday, even in, like, the Salvadoran Civil War, which I covered, where you had people, huge demonstrations in the capital, San Salvador, in 1979, and then the military, after a coup, sets up machine guns on the roofs of the building and guns everyone down in the street. Well, you're not going to march out into the street after that. And, of course, what happens is they built quite an effective insurgency. So in that sense, I'm not a pacifist in that I recognize that, you know, the inability of the state to respond rationally to the most basic demands of the citizenry and the use of repression, physical repression and coercion, to prevent people from even asking for what is often incredibly minimal rights, triggers violence. That violence of the state triggers violence. But then you get into the kind of poison of violence, and especially in the United States, I think you become much more susceptible to a kind of proto-fascist right-wing backlash, because these are all the people who have the guns.
So we face various forms of interlocking power and a very high concentration of power. And you write something really beautiful in this new book, which is, there is nothing rational about rebellion. To rebel against insurmountable odds is an act of faith without which the rebel is doomed. This faith is intrinsic to the rebel the way caution and prudence are intrinsic to those who seek to fit into existing power structures. I do not know if the new revolutionary wave and the rebels produced by it will succeed, but I do know that without these rebels we are doomed. So my question is, can this sense of faith be cultivated, or are people simply born or not born with an inner drive for justice?
I don't think it's cultivated. I'm talking about the rebel. I think it can be cultivated among those who are willing to follow the rebel. But I think the rebel is, it's almost a kind of DNA type. You know, I'm not into biological determinism. But there's something almost innate. I mean, it's like Noam Chomsky is 11 years old and in a school in Philadelphia, and he decides to stand up and write an essay supporting the Republicans in Spain. If I remember, I might have the story slightly wrong, but there was something that where he just stood up and defied everyone around him to give a voice to people who are being demonized. And I think it is in the same way, like a war correspondent, and I was a war correspondent for 20 years. It's a kind of personality type almost. Now, that personality type, being reared and conditioned in another way may not be a rebel. It might in fact be something pretty unpleasant. So I think there are factors that go into instilling a sense of justice, fairness, empathy, all of those. But that kind of, I mean, the things we would do in war, rational, sane people shouldn't do. And I think there was just something inherent into the psychological makeup of war correspondents and war photographers that led them to do it, because it not only wasn't prudent, it probably wasn't even sane. And I think the rebel has those kinds of qualities.
And what can we do to, as people who care deeply about revolt and care deeply about justice is a real point. What can we do to help propagate conditions that will make it more likely for these rebels to emerge, and B, make it more likely that, as things become increasingly chaotic, that, that whatever revolts take place will, in time, move toward justice as opposed to injustice, as you were talking about with Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia?
Well, we have to build disciplined movements that hold fast to moral imperatives and are willing to sacrifice for them. And we have to build communal structures to sustain those movements. And as you well know, we have a very long way to go. That is what corporate capitalism has done quite well, is destroy all truly communitarian structures and the ethic that comes with it. Of course, they started with the genocide against Native American communities because Native American culture was communal. It offered a competing ethic that capitalism had to wipe out, and it did. And our own movements have been wiped out in the name of anti-communism. I mean, we can start with the Wobblies, the Communist Party, the old anarchist movements, the old CIO. It's all gone. And in a way, those of us who care about any kind of egalitarianism and creating a society where we don't have poor and mentally ill people are not tossed on heating grates, and poor bodies are not thrown into cells or cages to generate money for corporate power. Education is, good education available to all, healthcare to all. The problem is that we don't even have movements, certainly not on a national level, that articulate these kinds of visions. And we need to build them fast, in the way that Syriza has built a movement and a political expression of that movement in Greece, the way Podemos in Spain has built a movement and a political expression. But the system, the political system in the United States is so closed, unlike, for instance, Canada, that it's not really even, I work for Nader, so I watched it up close. It's just not even feasible to mount a third party candidacy. I'm not talking about winning. I'm just talking about giving a political expression to a movement. You saw the Occupy movement, which posed no threat to the state at all. I mean, these were mostly yoga practicing, dumpster diving, college educated kids get wiped out. I mean, the state's response was to physically eradicate Occupy, which was nuts. Because if you keep doing that, if you keep crushing these movements, and the Occupy movement was a majoritarian movement in the sense that it really articulated the concerns of the mainstream about Wall Street, about student debt, about healthcare, about the environment, then, you know, its next incarnation is going to be more radical and less willing to compromise. And then, you know, in a kind of totalitarian system, which we live under, these people, of course, you know, they don't live in the real world. They don't even fly commercial airlines. They have no idea what you and I or anyone else out there, what our lives are like. They send in their militarized police forces to do it again. I mean, we see it with Black Lives Matter. So you march through the streets of Baltimore. You march through the streets of Ferguson. You march through the streets of New York. Now, Cleveland, we have images, video images of unarmed people of color being murdered by police, and police are not charged or prosecuted. And the longer this goes on, the more frustration builds. The longer the state is unable to respond rationally, the more people will lash out with a kind of incoherent and understandable rage. So, you know, you had a cop killed in New York. You had two cops killed in Mississippi. Hopefully these are isolated incidents, but if the state doesn't begin to respond, they won't be isolated.
How do we as people of good faith or people who want justice, how do we help to transform? I understand it, but I'm not a huge fan in itself of lashing out in incoherent rage. I am a big fan of harnessing that incoherent rage and channeling it into productive ends. How do we attempt to do that? How do we, as public intellectuals, how do you and I, and then how does anybody listening to this, how do we help to channel that into ends that ultimately serve justice?
We have to have a vision of what we want to replace corporate power. Because if we don't have a vision of what we want to replace corporate power, then any disruption becomes anarchic and chaotic towards no end and is easily dealt with by the state. It's when you have a vision in the way that Seresa has a vision of socialism, a lot of it coming out of Marxism, to replace the predatory capitalist system that the oligarchic rulers of Greece had implanted on the country and the international banking system, that you can begin to threaten the structures of power. And I don't think we're even at the point of articulating a vision, unfortunately. And I think that's part of the role of the left. It's why I'm a supporter of Shama Sawant, the socialist city council member in Seattle, in that she does have a vision, which you're watching now the Democratic Party work overtime to make sure she's defeated. I don't know, just talking about the Democratic Party in Washington State, nationally. So they're doing to her what they did to Nader, because a Nader or a Sawant exposes the Democratic Party for what it is. But we've got to build movements that have a political expression. That's not the same as building a political party. But building movements, and we've got to run candidates in local and national elections, not because we're going to win, because we're not, but as a way of fostering the movement. So the election is not an end in itself. And this, of course, is the great mistake that Bernie Sanders has made, which is to run as a Democrat. So we're going to hear a lot about the Koch brothers and nothing about the Democratic Party. He's not going to be allowed in the debates unless he agrees to endorse the candidate. And we're watching this macabre kind of coronation of Hillary Clinton. And then by April next year, it's over, and he endorses Hillary Clinton, and he funnels all of this energy and all of these people back into the embrace, like a kind of sheepdog, into the Democratic Party. This is what Van Jones did in the last election for the Democrats. And it's very frustrating because the longer we are deluded into believing that reform is possible, either through the democratic structure, the electoral process, the courts, legislative bodies, or anything else, the more time we're wasting. And given what's happening to the climate, we don't have any time left. Even if we stopped all carbon emissions today, our future would be very grim. And yet we're sitting here. I mean, March, every single day in March, carbon emissions were above 400 parts per million. That's the first time any month has had that level of that rate of carbon emissions since we started recording weather patterns. They were already predicting that this will be the hottest year in human history. They're talking about the summer Arctic sea ice disappearing by 2020. And we're sitting here being shorn like sheep. We have no time left. We have to stand up and break corporate power now. We have to radically reconfigure our relationship to each other and to the ecosystem now. And the longer we are essentially entranced by power, and they have very good systems of propaganda. I think you call them electronic hallucinations. That is a term, by the way, I steal from you all the time. It's a good one. I mean, the longer, you know, we're rendered passive, the more fatal what is before us comes. And, you know, that's why voices like yours and mine are pushed out of the mainstream, any kind of, even Nader, Chomsky, any kind of real critique of corporate power, of power, is not heard. And the insanity and absurdity of the commercial or mainstream media, I mean, it's almost vaudevillian at this point. So there's a discussion as to whether we should, I mean, the debate becomes whether we should bomb Syria or should we bomb Syria and send boots on the ground, as if those are the two options. So those are the two acceptable options to the corporate state and the arms industry, but those aren't the two options. And neither option makes any sense. I speak as the former Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. But it makes sense if you're selling weapons and you want to make money. Yeah, it's quite terrifying how effectively voices of sanity have been shut down, how the system has calcified to such an extent that it's now, I think, impossible for us to have any kind of a breakthrough, and how, you know, at a moment when we most need movements, we don't have any.
Everything you're saying is making perfect sense. And, you know, you wrote, we live in a system that's incapable of reforming itself. The first step to dismantling the system is to dismantle the ideas that give it legitimacy. Once that's done, though the system may be able to cling to power through coercion and fear for years, it will have been given a mortal blow. And so my question is, in a time of such deep anti-intellectualism, when even academic institutions won't stand up for the principle of open exchange of ideas, I mean, you've been deplatformed. I've been deplatformed. There's this website that covers deplatforming at universities that says that deplatforming is, quote, exploding. And,
I just got deplatformed at the University of Pennsylvania on Israel Palestine.
I just got deplatformed from Oregon State. It happens all the time. And my agent, Anthony Arnov, who's fabulous and great politically, he says that a lot of his writers, who are all really great politically, are getting deplatformed. It's an absolute explosion. Anyway, the point is, when academic institutions won't stand up for the principle of open exchange of ideas, how do we get anyone in the U.S. to engage with critical and probably very scary ideas?
Well, it's almost come down to one person at a time. I mean, now, you know, I give talks around the country and, you know, I can draw several hundred people, and sometimes over 1,000, but compare that to who you would reach if you had a half hour on PBS from 8 to 8:30. You can get on the New York Times bestseller list, as I did with my last book, but I sold 45,000 hardback. Now, 45,000 hardback, you know, what percentage of 1% is 45,000 hardback in terms of the general population?
42,000 people were at the Los Angeles Dodgers game last night.
Well, there you go. I mean, this is the problem. It's kind of the end of Rome, where people are investing their emotional and intellectual, such as they have it, life in spectacle. This is what Cicero wrote about. You know, all societies in decay, and ours is in deep decay, make war on artists and intellectuals because they offer up kind of ideas which are uncomfortable, and they provide an analysis of decay which doesn't correlate with the mantra of happy thoughts that societies of spectacle pump out. And totalitarian societies are always image-based, spectacle-based societies. So the war against independent thought and independent artistic expression is quite pronounced. And the way they do it is they make it almost impossible for you to make a living. So if you conform, and I certainly could have conformed to the academic standards, the committees, the tenure track, then there can be a place for you. But I would say you're no longer an intellectual, you're a courtier. You, in essence, are serving a system of power, either through silence or conformity. And if you don't do, if you're not either silent in terms of critiques of power, or you don't conform, then they throw you out. That's what they've done to my friend Norman Finkelstein, who's one of the great scholars on the Middle East, hands down. Yeah, it's been, you know, that, I mean, at least they're not hauling us off to a gulag like Stalin, but at the same time, they're making sure we're not heard.
So you mentioned the end of Rome, and there's a great quote by Edward Gibbon that I want to mention. It's very interesting to me. In fact, it gives me some sort of solace to understand that a lot of the bizarreness we see around us is actually sort of predictable. He says the five marks of the Roman decaying culture: concern with displaying affluence instead of building wealth, obsession with sex and perversions of sex, art becomes freakish and sensationalistic instead of creative and original, widening disparity between very rich and very poor, and increased demand to live off the state.
Huh.
I just find that, you know, he wrote that, what, 240 years ago or whatever, and he about a previous time, but it's pretty straight on.
Well, because empires, you know, or civilizations decline, they have many of the same characteristics in terms of decline, and this is something that great anthropologists like Redmond and Joseph Tainter also grasped. And, you know, I studied classics at Harvard, and the classicists hate Gibbon, and they won't teach him, because Gibbon does what you're not supposed to do in academia, and that's actually make judgments. He's also a good writer. That may be something else. But
there's a line in Gibbon, you know, I read him when I was like 20 or something, and there's a line that stuck with me even then, even though I wasn't particularly politicized, which is the line was basically about how if we feel more sorrow at the burning down of a palace than we do of a hovel, that says terrible things about us as a people.
Right. That was Rome. I mean, Rome was, like our own culture, very violent society. And by the end of the Roman Empire, those people running it were either insane or they were idiots. Or at best, you know, they were managers for kind of a rapacious, predatory, oligarchic elite, which was completely militarized. I mean, after, after Nero, you ended up with who was the last direct descendant of Augustus. You ended up with Vespasian, who had just finished carrying out a genocidal campaign against Jewish rebels in Palestine. I mean, he was a killer, and his son Titus was a killer too. And so essentially you turned power, directly over to the most violent, you know, the elements, militarized elements of the empire. And, I think one of the things that's not talked about in American society is to the extent our society, like Rome, has become militarized. You can't, even whisper a criticism of the military. All things military are venerated. Nobody ever challenges the insane amounts of money. I mean, we just passed a bill, the House, to build 12 new Ohio class submarines. I think they're $8 billion a piece. We've just appropriated 300 and some billion dollars to upgrade our nuclear armaments. I mean, it's nuts. And of course, what happens when you get an uncontrollable military industrial complex that feeds off of the state, it kind of devours the country out from the inside. And that's what's happening. So, you know, Amtrak goes off the rails and our bridges are falling apart and our roads are crumbling and our schools are being closed. And, meanwhile, we're just dumping staggering sums of money. We spend, of course, five times what China, the next highest defense spender, spends in the world. And not only that, I mean, officially we spend 600 and some billion, but there's so many hidden costs. I mean, stuff moved over to other budgets, that in fact we're probably spending $1 trillion a year, building all sorts of weapon systems and which we don't need, and which are going to kill us in the end. I mean, both financially and probably quite literally. So, what I fear is that, you know, as the society continues to kind of slowly disintegrate, if we ever run into a crisis, hyperinflation, another act of catastrophic domestic terrorism, which given ISIS now is very likely, unlike Al-Qaeda, you have about 20,000 fighters in ISIS who have foreign passports, 4,000 to 5,000 of them, perhaps, have European passports. I mean, this was never true to Al-Qaeda. I covered Al-Qaeda for the New York Times. It's a very different organization, and the longer we keep bombing them, and since they don't have an air force, they'll do to us what we're doing to them. They'll just do it in a cruder fashion. We saw it when they burned the Jordanian pilot in the cage. I mean, our Air Force is burning whole families, incinerating whole families in their houses every single day. And, you know, what they did was cruder, but on a moral level, it was no different. So, I mean, we're kind of asking for it on many levels, both in terms of, this insane, endless war in the Middle East, the utter mismanagement of our economy and our failure to respond to climate change is kind of a perfect trifecta, which, you know, either one or all together could create a moment of great instability and crisis. And then it's almost at the flick of a switch, because not only have they militarized police, they've rewritten laws. So we're utterly powerless. We're the most watched, spied upon, photographed, monitored race in human history. And I covered the Stasi state of East Germany. you know, the ability legally to use lethal force against the citizenry. We see it with poor people of color. The state, I mean, you can kill with impunity. Our laws have been rewritten. You know, I sued Obama in federal court over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. Surprisingly, I won, and then it was appealed. But, I mean, this is an act that overturns over a century and a half of law to allow the military to carry out domestic policing, to seize American citizens, U.S. citizens, on American soil, in essence, extraordinary rendition, strip them of due process, and hold them indefinitely in military facilities. Well, you know, we were in contact with Pelosi's office during the lawsuit, which lasted 2 years, and we said we'd drop it if they just put in there that U.S. citizens were exempt. But they weren't going to put it in because they wrote it. They knew why they wrote it. They wrote it for precisely this reason. If they need the military to protect them, they want to be able to use it.
So I'm thinking there's another quote from your book that really spoke to me that really articulates, I think, a lot of the insanity that we're seeing around us. It says, when societies break down, their words, or at least the words used in everyday discourse, no longer make sense. What is real cannot be spoken about. What is not real is used to define the legal, moral, and linguistic foundations of society. And I think a lot of us have a very visceral understanding of this, where corporations are people, but various people aren't. And certainly a community isn't. Or, you know, Texas just banned the banning of fracking. And, you know, there are so many things that are never up for debate. But that's what I read in this. What do you actually mean by that, that paragraph?
Well, the language that we use to describe ourselves and our political reality doesn't correlate to what is actually happening.
I mean, bringing freedom and democracy to another country?
Well, that's always been a lie. I mean, that's always been used for domestic consumption while we murder the lesser breeds around the earth and steal their land and resources. We can start with westward expansion, but, you know, on to the Philippines and the Middle East and the Caribbean and Central America and everywhere else. It's more the idea that we live in a functioning democratic state, that we actually have any kind of input into how power is managed, and we don't. It's the idea that we actually have a voice. It's the idea that we actually have rights, which we don't anymore. I mean, we've essentially been stripped of our rights. You can't use the word liberty when you are watched by your government 24 hours a day. That is the relationship of a master and a slave. So the very language we use to describe our political reality is fictitious. The language we use to describe our agency as citizens is fictitious. But people are figuring that out. Now, they haven't figured out what they're supposed to do about it. But I mean, you see it with low voter turnout, what, 30% vote or something in national elections. Congress has a 7% approval rating. When we did polls on the NDAA, I didn't do them, but I mean, when there were polls done, there was a 97% disapproval rating, and yet this section of the NDAA passes anyway. You can go back to the bailout of 2008. Constituent calls 100-1 were against the bailout, but it passes anyway. It doesn't matter what we want. It makes no difference. I mean, Hillary Clinton is going to run a whole campaign, or at least in the primaries, sounding like you know, a Henry Wallace populist, in the same way that Barack Obama did in 2008. And then they get into power, and all her friends at Goldman Sachs, who have given her all the money to run, you know, write their own regulations, write their own laws, write their own legislation. So when I talk about the language we use even to describe the free market is fictitious. Most of these large corporations prey off of the state, not only in terms of looting the U.S. Treasury, but in terms of massive subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, for the banking industry, for the pharmaceutical and insurance industry through the Obamacare, $400 and some billion, which is just the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical insurance industry. That's not capitalism. That's not free market. That's not laissez-faire. I mean, every kind of ideology we use to describe, or, you know, every word that we use to describe supposedly the ideological systems that govern our lives are fictitious. They're false. And that puts us at a moment in history that Antonio Gramsci called the interregnum, where the old ideas are losing their currency very rapidly across, you know, left and right. But we have yet to articulate new ideas to take their place. And if we don't articulate new ideas to take their place, then that anger and rage will be funneled into these proto-fascist Christian right militia type movements, where a legitimate anger will be directed, as it always is in proto-fascist or fascist movements, towards the vulnerable. Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, intellectuals, feminists, liberals. And that is probably the dominant current within the American body politic, while people like you and I, you know, have very little resonance, unfortunately, you know, in a way that if you go back 100 years towards the old Wobblies or Mother Jones, you know, there was a very important place for radicals in the U.S. system. But, you know, after World War One and this kind of psychosis of permanent war, where you just purged all institutions of not communists or even people who are soft on communism, but anybody who had a social conscience, we've just been left utterly bereft and impoverished.
So we have about a minute or 2 minutes left. And what would you want if you were to, I mean, we covered a lot of ground here today. And if you were to encapsulate everything down to, sorry to do this to you, down to a soundbite, what would you want a listener to this to take away? And what do you want them to, how do you want them to change in their attitude / behaviors? What do you want them to understand and what do you want them to do?
I would say the system's irredeemable. Any attempt to work within or with the system is a waste of time. We don't have time anyway. Everything that we do now must be to overthrow the system, to overthrow corporate power. And if we don't overthrow it soon, then we are going to have to begin to discuss the extinction of the human species along with probably every other species.
Well, I completely agree with you, and it's why I do my work, and I'm sure it's why you do yours. I'd like to thank the audience members for listening. My guest today has been Chris Hedges. This is Derek Gentry from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. And thank you so much, Chris. Your work is incredibly invaluable.
Thank you, Derek.